Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Tomorrow is the full moon day, the Pavarana day, the formal closing of the rains retreat period, this 3 month long retreat time. And so I thought, and discussing it with various people today, that we could look upon this evening gathering as the formal closing of our community group practice period, and look at this as the drawing to an end, formal closing off of that retreat time that we've been spending together. Talk a lot about ultimate reality, and as people are very familiar with Lumpur Sumato's teachings, that you know, his favorite sutta quotation, at least in the last little while, he was referring to over and over again, is the passage from the Udana, the Buddha's inspired utterances, that there's the unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, the unformed. And if there were not the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unformed, then no escape would be possible from the born, the originated, the created, the formed. But because there is the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unformed, then escape is possible from the born, the create, the created, the originated, the formed. And the actuality of that transcendent truth, that transcendent reality, you know, the Dhamma, this is the foundation of our spiritual life. This is the basis and the goal of our spiritual life. That fundamental truth that lies at the heart of all things. But in a way, that's all very well to know that, or to have faith that that is the actuality, that that is the reality. It's all very well to have faith in that, or to see that from time to time, or to believe that that's true, or to intuit that is actually the case. But yet, in a sense, the main issue is, how do we mesh that realization with the world of what we see and hear and feel and smell and taste and touch? How does that reality mesh or interface with the felt experience of life as a human being, life of the sense world? In a way, how does the unconditioned interface with the conditioned? How do they meet? How do we live in accord with that? How do we manifest that realization in a practical, real, and genuine way? This is the question, the conundrum, in many respects, at least as far as I see it. In a way, to use a very coarse analogy, it's rather like saying, well, you've got piles of money in the bank, but how do you get at it? How do you put it to use? How do you take advantage and make use of that great resource, that actuality that's there? How do we bring it forth and fully realize it. Well, one of the qualities of the Buddha that I like to reflect upon that we recite in the daily chanting as the amongst the attributes of the Buddha is Vijja Charana Sampanno. Vijja is knowing or knowledge, understanding. Charana means conduct. Literally means walking. Like charity means to walk or to go, to fare. It also means our activity, our conduct. So Vijja Charana Sampanno means perfect in knowledge and conduct, or accomplished, impeccable in conduct and understanding, as it goes in our English translation. So these are, I say, a combination of qualities that are there embodied by the Buddha, and the Buddha being our spiritual archetype. Then I feel this is, say, representing a very important blending of qualities, because the vijja is the, say, the internal aspect that, on the level of mind, there's vijja, there is the quality of transcendence, of transcendent knowing. But that transcendent knowing manifests as a perfection of conduct. So not only is there, say, an inner realization of that fundamental reality of things, but that manifests itself, the way that takes shape in action and speech and in the world, is through a perfection of conduct. The Buddha's conduct in this being an archetype, being a model, an exemplar for us, that is represented as a perfection, an impeccability within conduct. Every action was in accord with the time, the place, the situation. Every word was true. Every word was well chosen, well placed in the life of the Buddha. Another way of talking about this is as we reflect upon the three refuges as internal qualities, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. We can say that the Buddha represents the wisdom mind, the awake mind, the knowing mind, that quality of vijja. Buddha means the one who knows, or the quality of knowing, awareness, wisdom, as well as referring to Gautama Buddha, the teacher, the founder. So Buddha represents wisdom, or the quality of knowing. Dhamma is not just the Buddha's teachings, but also represents the way things are, the fundamental fabric of reality. And Sangha represents not just the refuge of Sangha as the awakened disciples of the Buddha, but on an internal level, Sangha represents virtuous conduct or unselfish, noble conduct. So in this respect, if we look at Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha as internal qualities, we can, as well as the external values, we can say that when the Buddha sees the Dhamma, what arises is the Sangha. When the wisdom mind sees the way things are, what arises is virtuous conduct. So in a sense, this is that's the bridge, that's the connection between the conditioned and the unconditioned, between the transcendent knowing and the sense world, is this aspect of conduct, what you can call a sila dhamma, or the quality of virtue. This is just, you know, one way of reflecting on it, one means of talking about this area. But reflecting on this, I feel this is a good way to consider it, that if we are looking at how the realization of ultimate truth takes shape, then this is or how that is brought into being, how that is made actual in our lives, in our actions, in our speech. It's through just this quality of virtue, of sila. Now the word sila has two quite distinct meanings. Just like the word vipassana, I think a few days ago I was talking about how vipassana can refer to the practice of that particular kind of meditation, that, say, the applying the reflections on anicca, dukkha, anatta. So it's the word vipassana can refer to the mechanics of the practice, but the word vipassana also refers to the change of heart itself. So one aspect, you know, of it is just the what you have on paper, if you like, the wording of the practice or the description of the practice, and the other is more the change of heart that comes about. So like a recipe, you have just words printed on the page of a book that describe a recipe, and the actual mixture of ingredients and the tasting and eating of the food is something else altogether. So just as vipassana can refer both to the mechanics of the practice and also the change of heart, so sila too has these different layers of meaning. So sila doesn't just refer to the lists of precepts that we structure our lives around. It doesn't just refer to the 5 precepts, the 8 precepts, 10 precepts, the precepts of the Siladhara community or the precepts of the Bhikkhu community. It's not just the lists of rules, but sila is also referring to that the very quality of virtue, that purity of heart itself, that attribute of our being. So you can use the word sila dhamma for that quality of virtue itself. So I would suggest, or reflecting on this, I think this is a good way to see that this is the connection, the way that the realization of Dhamma, of ultimate truth, the realization of the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, how that takes shape or how that is manifested in our lives and in the world is through the quality of sila dhamma, that attribute of virtue within our own hearts. So another image that comes to mind is, you know, when we do a blessing ceremony and we wrap the cotton cord, the undyed cotton cord around the Buddha image 3 times, and then around the bowl of water 3 times, and then through the hands of that Sangha and so forth. Oftentimes, when I'm describing that, you know, following the symbolism that I've heard described by Lumpo and others, and particularly when people ask, well, what does it mean, you're having this thread around the Buddha and then going through your hands and so forth, that what I will say is that the Buddha represents the fundamental spiritual principle of the universe, the core reality, the ground reality of all things, that transcendent, timeless, formless reality that is the very fabric of all things, the foundation of all things. And then the thread, the undyed cotton thread, then represents, coming from the Buddha and then out around the water and then through all of our hands and so forth, is a representing the manifestation of that in the world, how that pure spiritual principle, if you like, how that manifests in the world, or how it comes out into the world and then connects all things. So when we live according to sila, guided by that quality of virtue, then our actions and speech are in accord with that fundamental reality. So what we experience is peace, what we experience is happiness, what we experience is a quality of unburdenedness, freedom from remorse, a buoyancy, a brightness of being. That's what is the natural result of living in accord with Dhamma, living virtuously. As the Buddha pointed out, one who who lives in accord with Sila, one who is guided by Sila, there's no need for them to think, may there be freedom from remorse within me, because it's natural. It's a completely natural result of living virtuously, of having the heart inclined towards virtue, that heart is naturally free of remorse. As you haven't done anything that's regrettable, so you don't regret it. And so then when there is a freedom from remorse, then that brings about a quality of delight, of pamoja. And when there is delight, then the body, the mind relaxes, as kaya samati, the whole being, our physical being relaxes, and this then enables there to be a quality of sukha, or contentment, a profound happiness. And when the sukha is established, then it's very easy for the mind to be concentrated. Samadhi is very easy to establish if the body is relaxed and the heart is content. The causes of agitation, that which would obstruct samadhi, are not present, so therefore it's much easier to focus the mind on the present moment, and for it not to be agitating to be somewhere else. If you're happy to be at Amaravati, you don't have to control any impulses to go somewhere else. So if you're content to be here, then you don't have to be fencing in any impulses to go other places. It's kind of common sense. And when there is a quality of samadhi, of attention to the present, then there's no, as the Buddha pointed out, there's no need to wish. May knowledge and vision of the way things are arise, because it's natural for one whose mind is focused, stable, attentive to the present moment. It's natural for them, within them, for the knowledge and vision of the way things are to arise. Insight arises naturally from the basis of concentration. And then when the insight arises, there's no need to wish, may I experience detachment and disenchantment, because when you see that everything is anicca, dukkha, anatta, that all of the phenomenal world are all aspects of the phenomenal world are in a state of change and cannot satisfy and are not ownable. They have no capacity to be owned or possessed or to be who and what you are. Then the urge to try and own them or to keep them for ourselves or to protect them or to hope that they will last, that fades away, because you know they can't. And so then he points out how with the qualities of disenchantment, of dispassion, then there's no, when they are present, there's no need to wish, may the heart be liberated, because it's completely natural. When there is that qualities of disenchantment, of dispassion, then there's a letting go, there's a freedom, there's the quality of liberation, of vimutti, that is the natural result of that disenchantment, of that coolness, that viraga, that dispassion within the heart. So when sila is established, even if it's just adopting the behaviors of sila, then it helps to bring the heart fully into accord with Dhamma and to awaken to the reality of Dhamma, and for that quality of truth, the quality of Dhamma as the timeless perfect reality becomes apparent, and the felt experience of the Dhamma, as Lumpo Cha would describe, using the alliterative phrase that he also Ajahn Buddhadasa used to like to use, sawang saat sangop, meaning sawang, meaning radiant, saat, pure, sangop, peaceful, pure, radiant and peaceful. And the Dhamma is realized when the Dhamma is known. The felt experience of knowing the Dhamma is there is radiance, purity and peacefulness. That's what's here when the Dhamma is known. Talking about this, also reflecting on this quality of vijja charana sampanno, the balance of the perfection of knowledge and conduct, the meeting of knowledge and conduct. I also like to use this phrase of unentangled participating. When we talk about, sometimes when we talk about knowing or awareness or non-attachment, we can create this, unconsciously we can create this an abstracted knower that's sort of off remotely watching everything and is somehow dissociated or disconnected from the sense world in an unskillful way. There's a shadow of vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of or to not feel or to not care or to dismiss. There's an unconscious or a semi-conscious pushing away or rejection or dismissiveness towards the conditioned realm, or towards sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. But to me, looking at the Buddha's life and the Buddha's way, and considering particularly this quality of vijja charana sampanno, that the Buddha's total detachment from and the utter realization of the transcendent reality manifested itself as an acute and precise care for every detail of his life. When you look through the Vinaya books, I mean, the degree to which the Buddha paid attention to every minuscule detail and established protocols, you know, rules and forms and structures around every tiny little aspect of our lives, extraordinary, incredible, the amount of time and effort and thoroughness that he put into sort of laying it all down in terms of precepts, but also just in the manner of his conduct as it's described in so many of the suttas and the Vinaya teachings. He was extraordinarily careful. He let go of the world completely, but that letting go of the world completely was based on an extraordinarily complete and total care for the world. So, you know, the Buddha loved the world and cared for it down to the tiniest detail. But that love of the world and that care for the world and the concern for all beings manifested itself as letting go of them completely. So there's a mysterious chemistry at work there, because oftentimes we think if we love something, then we're going to keep hold of it, protect it, and fuss over it, worry about it. But the Buddha so loved the world that he let go of it completely. And that letting go of the world and that transcendence of the world, the complete liberation from worldly conditioning, took shape as an acutely refined attention and care for every detail of living, every conversation, every action, every step taken, every word was carefully placed, thoroughly weighed and considered as it was made. So this is, I think, a beautiful and important principle to consider, because if we take the ideas of non-attachment or letting go in a slightly wrong way, if we grasp that from an attitude of vibhava tanha, the sort of a dismissiveness or a negativity or I don't want to be bothered with that conditioned stuff. That's just the conditioned world. It's just the world. Pah. Then we are we're still creating the world. We're still binding the heart to worldly attitudes and forms and thoughts. And it's a mysterious way that it works, but it's by, not being afraid to allow the heart to fully know the world and participate in the world, to accept it completely. That's how the heart transcends it. if we're still pushing it away or dismissing it or rejecting it belittling it, the world of the seen and heard and smelt and tasted and touched, then in a strange way we end up creating more solidity there. We create karma around it. And this, I feel, is so crucial to our understanding of practice, and that we should not be afraid or rejecting or dismissive of the sense world, of the world of things, of our actions, but scrupulous in every detail, that our care should be as refined as the finest flower. But our view of things, our attitude in terms of knowing or understanding the quality of vijja needs to be as broad and open, as wide as the sky. And it's tricky to hold these two things in balance. And as Lumpur Sumedho is often quoted, when he was a young monk, Lumpur Cha said to him one day, "Sumedho, you must find it really confusing, this monk's life, because on the one hand, the Dhamma says, let go of everything. And on the other hand, the Vinaya says, hold on and take care of everything, pay attention to everything. So that must be pretty confusing for you, because the Vinaya says, hold on, and the Dhamma says, let go." And then Lumpur said, when he thought about it, he said, "Yeah, actually, that is pretty confusing. I have been wondering about that." And then I think he, in the flow of his descriptions of that moment, he was half expecting Lumpur to then launch into this explanation of how it all fitted together. But then all he said was, "Well, when you figure out how when you figure out how those two fit together, you'll be fine." So that's the test for all of us, because it's not, in a way, an intellectual understanding of how they fit together, but finding that middle way, that balance, where we both let go of everything completely, but yet care about everything completely and sincerely, simultaneously, and without any hypocrisy or without any contradiction. To the thinking mind, it's weird and bizarre and difficult. But the wonderful thing is, we can find that point of balance. We can find that way of participating in the world, knowing our body, caring for our body, knowing our feelings, our thoughts, our moods, caring for the people around us, the objects, you know, the room that we live in, the walking paths that we tread upon, caring for. And making sure that sink is properly cleaned, that our shoes are lined up neatly parallel to each other, that the cobwebs have all been gently removed from every corner, that when we speak with each other, that we are speaking respectfully, gently, truthfully, appropriately. And that care needs to be genuine. And yet, at the same time, we need to be recognizing there's nobody here, there's no real person here, there's no real person there. These are all just patterns of the four elements known in consciousness, taking shape, dissolving. That's all that's going on. So on the conceptual level, these things can seem to contradict. But on the level of the heart, the level of direct realization, this is the middle way. This is the point where they meet, where these two qualities meet and fuse. That unentangled participating, the point of balance itself, this is the middle way. And the precepts that we have, the sila dhamma that we follow, this is all pointing and guiding our actions towards that middle way, where we can both live in accord with reality, with the transcendent Dhamma, but act and speak in a way that makes it as easy as possible for that Dhamma to be known, to be realized. So we are say, following the structures of precepts to keep our lives as uncomplicated as possible, to help prevent the kind of entanglement that comes. You know, when we are, say, acting aggressively, or when we are, say, greedy or possessive, when we are acquisitive, when we're trying to get things that aren't really ours, or trying to have things go our own way, when we're bending the truth to get some kind of personal advantage. We create tangles. That's what is the source of entanglement. As one poet put it, I think it was Sir Walter Scott, in one of his poems said, "What a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. What a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." When you start bending the truth for the sake of a good story or some personal advantage, then we have to sustain the lie. And then it gets really complicated and goes on. And we dig ourselves in deeper, and we create a tangled web that's very hard to extricate the heart from. Oh, and we speak of practicing Vinaya and taking these structures to guide our lives. And it's also important to consider, to reflect that the Vinaya standards, the Sila Dhamma that we live by, whether it's the five precepts, the eight precepts, whatever the structure of the Sila, whatever the particular pattern of Sila we are committed to, that this is in a way when we look at the forms as they're described on paper, the wording, you know, it's important to recognize these are resolutions. They're setting an intention. I undertake the precept to refrain from. It's setting a direction. And then for those of us who have gone forth, who are ordained in the Siladhara order, the Bhikkhu order, the Samaniras, and the Garikas, you know, there's a firm commitment to those principles. But it's important to recognize these are ideals. They are we are undertaking to live in accordance with those forms. But the fact is, we make mistakes. We do say things that are not quite true. We do act in ways that are harmful. We do find ourselves drawn into acting through indulgence or through fearfulness, or acting in ways that are aggressive or hurtful. We make mistakes. We lose our way. This is natural. This is ordinary. And one of the things I like to emphasize in this area is that the Buddha Dhamma is not built around never making mistakes. You know, the Buddha didn't say, you know, anyone who's considering themselves my disciple will never make a mistake. You do not find that in any part of the Tripitaka. Rather, what you find over and over again is what the Buddha says is to recognize your transgression, to recognize your mistake as being such, and to endeavor to do better in the future. This is called development in the Buddha Sasana. This is called furtherance or development. So he doesn't say, you know, you should never make a mistake. He recognizes we make mistakes. We miss our shot. We get fooled by perceptions of the liked, the disliked, fooled by habits of conditioning and urges of aversion and desire, fear, biases of various kinds. We get tricked. That's what happens. But having been tricked, having followed some attractive object, having acted harmfully against some irritating object, having spoken deceitfully to get something that you want to go in your preferred way, then to notice that, to be aware of that, and to recognize that was a missed shot, that was poorly done, that was a hurtful thing to do, that was a greedy impulse to act upon. then to see that error and to make efforts to do better in the future, to set the resolution to do better. This is development. So in this respect, it's important to understand how hiriyotapa works. These pair of qualities, that when we are wanting to live in accord with Vinaya, with the Sila Dhamma, when we want to live our lives fully in tune with Dhamma and try to live according to the Sila Dhamma, then to recognize we're going to miss our shot, we're going to make mistakes. But if we then take that mistake and then create a negative self-view, oh, I'm such a useless person, I'm so stupid, I'm so corrupt, I'm a failed, idiotic, useless excuse of a Buddhist. How dare I walk around calling myself a Buddhist? I live in a Buddhist monastery, I wear the Buddhist robes, I shave my head, you know. We take that mistake and compound self-view around it. So this is not hiriyotapa, this is creating a guilt trip. So it's important to understand what this principle is referring to and how it works. And so the word hiriyotapa is really two words put together, hiri and otapa. So hiri is something like, there's no perfect English word that describes it, but it's something like the word honor or conscience, a sense of beautiful conduct within yourself, or noble conduct within yourself. What is honorable? What is noble? And when we tell a lie, or we take something that doesn't belong to us, or we are, act in a hurtful way or a destructive way, then that feeling in the heart that goes, oh, yeah, that wasn't quite true, or that was really pretty aggressive, or that was hurtful to that person. That pain in the heart, that's hiri, that feeling of conscience, having broken your honor, having gone against the code of honor. That painfulness is hiri. And so that's a parallel quality to physical pain. Just as physical pain protects the body, so that we don't hurt ourselves, we keep the fingers out of the candle flame, because we know if the skin, flesh gets burned, then it'll be broken up, it'll be subject to infection, it can cause all kinds of difficulties. So the pain protects us, keeps us away from dangerous situation. Physical pain protects the body. So in exactly the same way, then hiri and otapa, they protect the heart. They're a painful quality, they are an unpleasant experience, but they are unpleasant to protect, just as pain is unpleasant. So you'll get to a place where you don't feel it, you'll take the finger out of the candle flame so it doesn't hurt. So in exactly the same way, hiri otapa is an uncomfortable feeling, but it's skillful, it's useful, because it protects the heart, it protects us from getting into dangerous or destructive situations. And otapa, again, there's not really any perfect English word for it, but it's more like it's pointing to the sense of the off-putting qualities of the unwholesome. So when you see somebody acting in a way that's violent or deceitful or coarse, then it's that in the heart which pulls away, it recoils, that which recoils from the unwholesome. And the Buddha used a simile of like when you drop a sinew, like a piece of meat falls into the fire with like a muscle with a sinew on the end, then the sinew will just coil up, like, and then it makes a little spiral and retreats from the flame quite automatically. Just as soon as it gets close to the heat, it'll just coil up and withdraw. So in the same way, the heart, when it meets with the unwholesome, when you see around people who are, say, violent or tell lies or act in a coarse or aggressive, unwholesome ways, then that in the heart which recoils, which withdraws, which inclines away, that's otapa. So that these are together they're called the lokapalas, or the guardians of the world, and outside the doors of this temple, the devas that on the either side of the door, the one in blue and the one surrounded by red, those represent Hiri and Otapa. They are the protectors, the bright protectors, the lokapalas. They are what guard the heart. So when we understand how Hiri Otapa works for us, then it's also, you sometimes have them translated as a sense of shame or conscience. So these are to be recognized as something that are helpful. They are what, say, keeps it clear when our actions do not accord with Dhamma, when our way of being is not in tune with that fundamental reality, not in tune with the natural order of things. Then that pain in the heart from Hiri Otapa, that's representing that discord, it's representing that moment of delusion. The mind is caught by a bias of fear, of aversion, of desire. And so it's alerting our attention to that, the fact that our actions are not in tune with that reality. There's a disconnect between the fundamental reality and the way that our action, our attitude is taking shape. So it brings that to our attention. And so when there's a spiritual maturity, then that the sense of Hiri Otapa gets stronger and stronger. So one who is spiritually mature has a very strong sense of Hiri Otapa, a very strong sense of shame. So in Western psychology, it might sound like to have a strong sense of shame is really a neurotic problem. But in terms of Buddhist psychology, it's taken as a sign of great maturity and spiritual strength. And so it's important to understand how these work. Now, when we experience that sense of conscience or a sense of shame or regret at our actions, then at that point it's very important to not allow self-view to form around it. But as the Buddha said in that little phrase, to recognize our transgressions as such and to endeavor to do better in the future, this is called furtherance. So it's important to find that balance point where we recognize, yeah, that was poorly done. I was acting out of fearfulness. I was feeling insecure, so I acted aggressively, or I acted selfishly. That was poorly done. So there's a recognition of the mistake, of the error, but we're not building up self-view around it. It's like, yeah, that was not on the mark. That was off the central line, that was off key. So that doesn't have to be something that we carry around as a guilt trip, or say I'm a terrible person, or on the other hand, making excuses, well, that didn't really happen, or they shouldn't make a problem out of it, or they need to get over it. People are too fussy, they just need to know I'm like that. It's justifying ourselves, or just blotting it out, that didn't really happen. let's not go there. I didn't really do that. Those are all ways that we are still out of accord with Dhamma. Our heart is not in tune with Dhamma. But the power and the beauty of Hiri Otapa, why these are the bright protectors, they bring brightness to the heart, is because they are able to alert that quality of being out of tune, they alert us to that sense of being out of tune. But if they are worked with wisely, then there's no sense of self around that. There's no when we act wholesomely and there's a sense of peacefulness or brightness, we don't claim that, like, oh yeah, how beautiful and bright my mind is because I'm so my precepts are so good. What a wonderful pure person I am. We don't create inflation or a sense of self around the positive results of living virtuously, and nor do we create the negative self-view, oh, I'm such a terrible person, I'm so awful, I'm so corrupt, I'm so useless. But rather, we see, oh, when there's virtue, when there's virtue and things, action and speech is in accord with Dhamma, then the result is happiness, peacefulness, clarity. It's not a person, it's not a self, it's not an identity, and not an individual. And then when we see our action is cruel and selfish, greedy, dishonest, tangled, then the experience is one of painfulness, of regret, of confusion, of stress and burdenness, alienation. That's the result. And that's not a person either. it's just a web of tangled dukkha that's being experienced. So that when we are able to apply or recognize the principles of Hiriyotapa, then they really serve us. They are extraordinarily helpful, and we can use them to keep our lives on track, to bring our life into accord with that reality, so that it's something to be cultivated, something to be cherished. So when you do something that's unwholesome, when you break a promise, or you act selfishly, you deceive somebody, or you hurt something, then when you feel bad, it's great. You should say, oh, how marvelous, and I feel so terrible. This is a wonderful thing that I feel so bad. And this is not trying to be perverse. This is how I find it's most helpful to recognize, oh, it's really good that I feel so bad. Because the fact that this feels so bad makes it that much easier not to follow the same action again in the future. How marvelous that I feel so awful. Not because you're sort of being masochistic, but recognizing, oh, this is great. This is a miserable feeling that's come from having deceived that person, or acted in a greedy way, or an aggressive way. How marvelous! Because it's showing us how to not follow the same mistake in the future, and how to bring our life into accord with Dhamma. So this kind of arousing of the vision, this insight into how things work, is a great resource that we have. And when we do this, then we find that all of the different aspects of our life, that as our karma of our birth takes shape and unfolds, then we can let things end. We can let things come to their conclusion. Just that the habits of our conditioning take shape as they do, the responsibilities that we have, that we've taken on, and our different roles in our life, in the community, they take shape as they do. We carry out the work that we need to in the best way that we can, but we're letting the karma end. We're just letting the causes that have already been created, you know, wear themselves out, and we're not creating more karma in the present, so that then we're not creating the causes for the effects, the vipaka, to ripen, so that our life, our training becomes built around the what they call the karma that leads to the end of karma. It's that working with our life, our energies, our human condition, to be ending birth, to be bringing about the ending of the causes of rebirth, so that we are using the faculties that we have, the potential that we have as human beings, to fully realize and know this human condition. So we're experiencing the effects of past causes, but we're not. But in the present moment, we're not creating the causes for more birth, for more confusion, for more entanglement in the future. We're letting things end. We're letting things sort of wear themselves out, and letting the natural processes run through and come to their conclusion. And when things end, then we leave them alone. Yeah. Te sang upasumo sukho. In their passing is peace. So this retreat time that we've had together this last week or so, between the half moon and then tomorrow's full moon, this is coming to its conclusion. So we will take this gathering this evening as the formal ending for the retreat time. And so tomorrow morning, we don't need to have any kind of organized group sitting. People are welcome to come to the temple if you choose to meditate, but we won't have a formal group sitting. And then we have the Pavarana ceremonies mid-morning for the nuns community, monks community. And then tomorrow evening we'll have the usual observance day gathering with taking the precepts and meditation, Dhamma talk, vigil and so on. And so as per usual for the full moon day, but tomorrow morning can be open, so people can you can feel welcome to practice on your own. But we will take this opportunity to close the retreat and to share the blessings of this to end this evening, and also just to consider, you know, that the quality of ending, drawing to a close. Te sang upasamo sukho, when things come to an end, if we leave them alone, then what remains is peacefulness. And you might think, well, that was a great retreat, that was really so wonderful, I wish you could carry on. You know, this is not letting it end. This is continuing the grasping. Or you might be thinking, oh, thank goodness that's over, all that group practice is driving me nuts, my knees are screaming, I've had enough of this. That's not letting it end either. Letting it end means recognizing the flow of enthusiastic feelings, the flow of negative feelings, the flow of neutral feelings. It's recognizing, oh, this retreat arose and now it's passed away. It came into being, it had its different characteristics, like anything else in our life. This body comes into being, integrates, then disintegrates. It was young and vigorous, now it's flabby and fading. That's what it does. Things come to their end. And when we let it end, we let things cease. We really leave it alone. Just let a condition come to its conclusion. There's a tremendous, an extraordinary, an awesome peace. That is all that remains. A vibrant, living peace is what remains. So on that note, I will offer these thoughts for consideration. And please, whatever is useful, take it and keep it. And whatever is not, please leave it aside. Andamayam dhamma ovarigata sadhukaram dhammasaya.